All right, I will call this hearing of Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is March 5th, 2024. We do have a quorum. First item on the agenda will be approval of the minutes. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes of February 29th?
So moved, Madam Chair.
All right, Vice Chair Frazier moves the minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Minutes are approved. We do have a full agenda today. Just to remind folks, testifiers signed up in advance and were instructed on how many minutes they have so we can fit more people in. So nobody's feelings should be hurt. We're all going to follow the same rules. First up, we've got Representative Curran. You ready? All right. Representative Curran, would you like to move to re-refer House File 4153 to the Housing, Finance, and Policy Committee?
Yes, Chair, that is my motion. Thank you.
All right, the bill is before us. Representative Curran, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you so much, Chair and Committee. House File 4153 is a simple bill that clarifies existing statutes and rights. It would require that landlords who require additional fees for renters with pets to list in their lease that service animals are exempt from any required deposits or additional pet rent. This bill seeks to protect renters with disabilities. And all renters who may or may not understand their tenant rights under existing statute. Service animals have been exempt from additional deposits or fees for years in Minnesota, and this bill will simply clarify the statutes and proactively protect renters in Minnesota. This bill also provides an enforcement mechanism to allow tenants to recover fees if their landlord didn't provide this disclosure in their lease. And I have available online, we had some letters, I believe, and I just, since members don't have in their packet, if I might read a testimony.
Yeah, if you
thank you.
Keep it to the point.
I will keep it to the point.
Thank you, Representative Curran.
all right, thank you, Chair. So this quick testimony is from Jack Fisher in St. Paul, who had been diagnosed with a disability since 2020. And when he entered his first lease after college, he spent a lot of time reviewing the contract, took a lot of pride in taking the time to spend that due diligence in understanding that commitment. The landlord required that he pay a pet deposit as well as ongoing pet rent. And as a new renter and someone unfamiliar with housing, he paid the full deposit and paid pet rent for 11 months before understanding that state law prohibited these fees. After approaching the landlord, who was a large, who provided large rental property services in the Twin Cities area, he asked for a rental credit and directed them to statutes. That request was denied for any refunds, despite various phone calls and emails. So that is what this bill seeks to rectify. This person lost a little under $1,000 from this whole ordeal, which might not seem like a lot to folks, but for many folks, that is a considerable amount of money. So that is what we are seeking to fix today.
All right, thank you. I've got one testifier signed up, Leanna Stefaniak. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for having me here this morning. My name is Leanna Stefaniak. I am general counsel for At Home Apartments, which is a housing provider located in St. Paul. For background, I'm here today just because I have some concerns about the proposed language. I was one of the original stakeholders that worked on 504B113 when it was passed several years ago. It was a group effort. It was, you know, folks like myself, the Minnesota Disability Council, Minnesota Legal Aid, the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. We all worked together on this bill because we were truly trying to find the balance of protecting the rights of our residents that had a bona fide need for a service or support animal against the fraud that was happening. Cottage industries were popping up just for the business of selling these letters for people who were just trying to bypass policies, and that was an affront to the people who truly need it for their disability-related need. I'm all for the disclosures. I just think that the language needs to be tweaked a little bit, and I would be happy to work with the author to work on some of that. Mainly, it's just making sure that this statute exists to protect those rights, but it's still a qualified right, and we still have to make sure that the residents who are seeking this accommodation are going through the proper steps as outlined earlier in the statute, specifically you know, subdivision two, where it talks about the requests that you need to make and the documentation that you need to provide. Again, the original intent was to strike that balance to protect those who need it against those who are trying to abuse it. The proposed paragraph C, where it is talking about if the tenant can make a claim for recovery if they would have made a reasonable accommodation and they could have gotten it, but they only know about it if the disclosure was made. I would argue that our residents who do have a disability-related need are aware of their disability-related need. They don't need a disclosure to trigger them to do that. In favor of making sure that landlords are being transparent about this, but I just think the language needs to be tweaked a little bit, and I'm happy to work with you on that if you're open.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. Member discussion. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Pinn, Representative Grant, I understand why you're doing this. It's unfortunate. We do have a few individuals housing providers that abuse this, but we have it in statute now that it's already in law that they cannot do that. Charge fees for those that actually qualify for either a service animal and in the statute emotional support. But in this bill, the tenant. If the tenant can go after and recover any fees. My question is, what does the housing provider do to recover things that when a person uses this falsely and inappropriately to have a pet instead of actual emotional support or a service animal?
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the question. It's my understanding that if there are any disputes between a renter and a housing provider that is a breach of contract, that they would still have a right to take that to court if there's any sort of breach of contract on either side, is my understanding.
Representative Johnson. All right. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Pinn and Representative Curran. I just wanted to make sure that I'm understanding that this bill puts the onus of disclosure on a landlord rather than expecting an individual to know the law. Is that correct?
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, Representative Finke, that's correct.
All right, so, Representative Finke.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. So it wouldn't be... We wouldn't be doing anything other than saying individuals who live with disabilities and have rights that are protected aren't expected to know every part of the law, right? We are expected as a government to make sure that their needs are being met.
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. And yes, thank you for that question, Representative Finke. You're absolutely correct. And I would note, too, that this is available online, but again, not available in members' packets today. I will note that we did receive a letter from the Minnesota Council on Disability fully supporting this, mostly for reasons that you just described.
Representative Finke. And I do want to note, Representative Johnson had mentioned emotional support animals, and that actually is a separate thing than a service animal, and service animal is defined by the ADA, and I believe this references back to the federal definition. So, again, it's the dogs or mini horses. not seeing any more discussion, Representative Curran, closing comments.
Thank you so much for the time today. Thank you for the discussion and the questions. If there is language to work on, I'm happy to work with folks on that.
All right. I will, Representative Curran renews their motion that House File 4153 is going to the Housing, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. All right. Next up. Representative Clardy, are you here? I thought I saw you. Yeah. All All right. I will move to recommend that House File 3470 be placed on the General Register. Representative Clardy, welcome to the committee. Please tell us about your bill.
Good morning. I'm Representative Clardy. Thanks so much, Chair Becker-Finn and representatives for allowing me to present House File 3470. So the purpose of this bill is to modify the definition of the criminal justice agencies, amending Statute 2022, Section 1302, Subdivision 3A, to include the Minnesota National Guard. So it will read, criminal justice agencies mean all state and local prosecuting authorities, all state and local enforcement agencies, the Sentencing Guideline Commission, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, the Department of Correction, the Minnesota National Guard, and all probation officers who are not part of the judiciary. So this will clarify that the Minnesota National Guard's ability to receive law enforcement and investigatory data from the civilian law enforcement authorities for use in administrative and disciplinary procedures under the Code of Military Justice when the local authorities decline to prosecute under jurisdiction.
All right. I understand you have a testifier. Director Kerr, if you could introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Don Kerr, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Department of Military Affairs. Thanks for hearing the bill today. This is an agency initiative, and Madam Chair, you may recall in a previous session, we moved some legislation that established the BCA to do certain investigations when members of the National Guard were involved. We've also run into some situations now where law enforcement agencies, out of an abundance of caution, have been reluctant to release investigatory data because we were not listed as a criminal justice agency. And in addition to law enforcement agencies, we've also had some challenges when we're doing suicide investigations for some coroners to not recognize the legitimacy of our request for information. And we think this change will clarify that and make it easier for us to get the information that we need to do our DOD investigations and report back to DOD and to take action when necessary against members who may have erred. That's basically it.
All right. Any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? Right, not seeing any, we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Weens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Representative Clardy and Mr. Kerr. You answered the question, Mr. Kerr, and that is, where have you had the difficulties? And on especially the investigations that we were plagued with for quite some time and having that frustration so you couldn't get the right information. I applaud this particular piece of legislation, and thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Clardy and Director Kerr, for this bill. We did work to ensure that those sexual assaults by Guard members against other Guard members were investigated by the BCA, and I'm glad that we're closing this loophole. I didn't realize that this loophole existed, so just wanted to say thank you.
And Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Clardy, I don't think you've had a bill in this committee yet. Has she?
We've heard a lot of bills. I don't know.
Well, welcome. You know, we're a friendly bunch. We really are.
Thank you. Especially on Chapter 13.
Yes, we are. So, no, I think this is a good bill and the one that follows as well. And it sounds like it's been needed. And so I'm glad that the bill's here and we can make sure that's even though it's a small word, you know, change, it's meaningful. So thank you.
All right, thank you. Representative Clardy, closing comments.
Thank you for hearing the bill.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion to recommend that House Bill 3470 be placed on the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Greenman. I recognize it logically would have made more sense to do the Coulter bill next, but he's not here. So we're playing, we're trading members with the state gov this morning. Welcome, Representative Greenman. I will move to recommend that House Bill 3456 be placed on the General Register. I understand you also have an A6 amendment. Do you want to do the A6 first?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I will move the A6. Representative Greenman, if you want to explain the need for the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this amendment, which was a very similar amendment, was adopted in the Senate, makes this bill not retroactive to contracts that currently exist, and adds for current contracts that currently exist a requirement that folks provide notice to employees of the law and the provision in the contract.
All right. Any discussion to the A6? All right. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Greenman, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I am grateful to be back in judiciary to present this bill, which is about prohibiting restrictive employment covenants in service contracts. It closes a loophole to ensure that Minnesota's prohibition on non-competes and no-poach agreements is not evaded in service contracts that are signed above the heads and often without the knowledge or consent of the workers being impacted. Restrictive employment agreements like this, non-competes, and others are found in service contracts that include prohibitions on workers and are barriers to the freedom to work and fair competition. They restrict workers from being able to seek better wages and working conditions, and they limit workers' career growth within an industry. And we talked a lot about this last session, but just one note, the FTC estimated that clauses like this deprive American workers of between $250 billion and $296 billion a year in income. Last session, we took a big step forward in protecting workers in this arena, and this bill is about closing a loophole to make sure all workers have access to those protections. We passed those bills last year with a clear intent of protecting Minnesota workers from the practice of using restrictive employment covenants to limit the freedom of movement and opportunity for workers. But this summer, we found and learned of practices, the shadow non-compete, where companies are including restrictive employment provisions in contracts between two parties that don't include the worker. They have the same impact as a non-compete, limiting those job prospects, wages, career growth, but they're worse because workers don't often know about them. So what this bill does is simple. It says you cannot restrict or prohibit a customer from hiring an employee of the service worker. You'll hear from one testifier. We heard a lot of testimony in labor about this from, I think, 7 or 8 workers, but we'll have one. And this loophole closer is modeled on the prohibition of no-poach agreements, which you may be familiar with because that came through your committee last year. Two entities can't contract with an employment restriction. So with that, I'd say, members, this is an important bill to ensure that the protections that we passed last year apply to all workers, often low-wage workers or workers who may not know this exists. And with that, Madam Chair, I think of one testifier and whoever else has signed up.
Yep. We do have a couple people signed up. First up, I have Brian Shea, and then I have Jeff Tollefson on deck. When I tell you you're on deck, that means get closer to the table so we don't waste time with you walking around. welcome to the committee. Mr. Shea, please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Brian. Pardon me. My name is Brian Shea. I worked 6 years for First Service Residential Minnesota, most of those years as the overnight desk attendant at Gallery Tower here in St. Paul. In April 2023, coworkers and I learned about First Service Residential's restrictive covenants from an article in the American Prospect, not from our employer. Wanting to know how many of us were affected, we organized a petition. There was a telling difficulty in collecting signatures. What we were describing made no sense to people. It made no sense that there would be a restriction on their employment that they had never heard of or agreed to. Right? It didn't make sense that these covenants could exist and we couldn't point to them because we're not parties to the contracts. Right? So eventually, despite that, we got 48 coworkers to sign our petition, ask management how many of us were affected by the covenants. Management would not answer. Another desk attendant, Josh, asked the former First Service Minnesota vice president about the covenants at a neighborhood association meeting. He would not answer. A group of coworkers and I approached him at a company-sponsored event to ask the same questions that remained unanswered, and again, refused to answer, left the event. If there's nothing dodgy about these contracts, why dodge that question? Right? If they're an appropriate condition of employment, why hide them from employees? This past December, the overnight shift at Galley Tower was eliminated and I was laid off. Looking for work, I have no way of knowing whether or where these covenants restrict my employment. And even if I did know, the existence of the covenants still limits employment opportunities and it distorts the labor market. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, I have Jeff Tollefson and then Tara Wyborny on deck.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Tollefson. I'm the president of the Minnesota Technology Association. I'm here to highlight some of the far-reaching consequences of House Bill 3456 can and will have on Minnesota's business community and innovation economy. Companies large and small hire outside consultants and contractors for increased efficiency and productivity, allowing them to access specialized skills that might not exist in-house, and the flexibility to scale as needed as projects, resources needed are up, go up and down. But the benefits that stem from having access to high-quality contracted talent are put at significant risk with the passage of this bill. Many of you may have utilized a temp to hire or a contract to hire staffing service where you immediately bring on board talent in kind of a try before you buy opportunity. And this benefit often comes with a pre-negotiated conversion fee where all parties benefit, the company, the contracting firm, and the employee. Technology consulting firms invest a lot of time and resources recruiting skilled talent and providing specialized training. If client companies where those contracted employees are deployed have an unfettered ability to directly hire those individuals at any time, many of these consulting firms would choose not to operate in our state. This legislative intervention into established business practices will also harm our state's workforce development initiatives. Apprenticeship programs that serve as employers of record for participants on the on-the-job training element of the work would be adversely impacted. These programs play a vital role in skilling our next generation workforce and allowing unrestricted hiring of apprentices before training programs have a chance to recoup their investment will discourage the private sector from provisioning these services, putting the burden back on state-funded programs that have not necessarily achieved the scale and success as private sectors. Actions have consequences, and the unintended consequence of passing this bill in its current form are profound. We look forward to working with the bill's authors on some new language that hopefully can address some of these concerns. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Tara Wyborny, please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tara Wyborny. I am the Vice President of Talent Development for Genesis 10. I'm here to provide feedback on the consequences HS 3456 will have on workforce development and the tech industry in Minnesota. Genesis 10 is an IT staffing company and consulting firm here in Minnesota with connections to many of our largest employers. Our business specializes in identifying and providing our clients with highly skilled technology consultants through contracting agreements. These contracts with our clients lay out a minimum time on contract and or fees that will be paid prior to our clients hiring our employees full time. Our employees can seek work at any other employer during this contract term. However, they cannot accept employment at the client they're contracting with until the terms of our agreement with the client have been met. These agreements, a try before you buy model, allow us to recoup investment and make a profit while providing an important service to our clients. The impacts of HF 3456 have a broad implication to workforce development in our industry. In addition to our core service, Genesis 10 has made a meaningful impact on the tech talent market in Minnesota through Dev 10. Dev 10 was launched in 2018 here in Minnesota using the same contract to hire model. Dev 10 hires and trains diverse pools of people and provides them or that do not have technical degrees or experience and provides them a pathway to launch their career as software and data engineers. In order to train our employees, we have to invest heavily in wages and benefits while they are in training, in addition to building and maintaining our technical curriculum and employing a technical staff that can execute on our training. This training runs 12 to 16 weeks in length, and after that, we recoup our investment through that contract-to-hire model. We have trained and deployed over 400 new software and data engineers here in Minnesota since 2018. 52% of that pool identifies as diverse. Of that, 85% have converted to become full-time employees of our client site. That is the intent of Dev10 here in Minnesota. This has driven meaningful impact to the diversity of our tech talent workforce. For Genesis 10 to continue to offer our services in Minnesota, we need the assurance that the contracts we have in place with our clients are enforceable. If they are not enforceable and the minimum terms set out in our contracts are void, our clients could hire these employees at any point in time, negating our ability to recoup that significant investment that we made in their wages, in their training, and in launching their career in technology that they could not have done without the resources we brought to bear.
Please wrap up, and then I have a quick question.
We believe, as written, that HF 3456 will remove our industry's ability to enforce these contract terms.
I've heard the phrase twice now, try before you buy. What are you buying?
You're able to convert a person into a full-time employee of your staff. So they're able to have them work as a contractor on their technology teams to see, hey, are you a good fit? Do you meet our cultural and technical needs on this team?
Okay, so buying people.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you for your testimony. Any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? Right, not seeing any, we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn, and thank you, Representative Greenman, for the offline conversations we've had about this bill. And for this amendment, I do think it moves things a small step in the right direction in terms of clarifying, I think, or taking away one potential legal constitutional problem with this bill. And I am curious, though, about how I haven't given a lot of thought to this compelled notice requirement and how that works and whether that is subject to some sort of a legal potential problem. I understand we have some other notice areas, you know, required notice areas and other areas of labor law, but how does it work here where we're saying that a specific employer has to sort of evaluate whether their contracts come within the scope of this law and then affirmatively go and speak to particular employees about that?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Niska. And I think it's a good question. So the reason we adopted the amendment was because of the contracting issues and existing contract. And it does, there's sort of the balancing test when it comes to the contract clause. This doesn't affect, this says if you have a current contract, doesn't disrupt the contract, but if you have, and you should know if you have one of these restrictive employment and covenants, but your workers won't. And so like all sorts of other things we do in labor law, requiring employers to provide notice of their legal obligations under the, you know, minimum wage or whatever else, I think that this fits in that category of it's a worker notice that this contract exists, and so that they can decide and they have the freedom to decide what to do about that. As you heard from our testifier and I've heard from lots of other folks, there's no requirement in these contracts that workers even know that they exist. They may have their employment limited or they may have restrictions that they don't know that are happening above their heads. So that's what this is the balance this strikes is saying, if you have a current contract, that language will continue, but you at least need to tell your workers about that and the legal change.
Right, Representative Niska.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. Thank you, Representative Greenman, for that answer. I guess big picture, I don't think this is striking the right balance, and we've had a little bit of a conversation about this before. I appreciate the potential problem of transparency, and there's a potential problem of maybe too large of a buyout that is restricting the movement or you know, freedom of workers to move. And Chair Becker-Finn, I appreciate your point that using the word buy in this context is at best kind of a clumsy way to talk about it. But we are talking about situations in which a service provider in the middle is really providing real value in all of these circumstances. So the worker who was here from First Service was providing an important connective service between the building and that person who might not have otherwise, you know, ended up at First Service in the first place. When we're talking about talent providers, consulting, you know, providing consultants, they are providing a real value of connecting people with, you know, connecting people who want to do work with people who want to pay for work. And sometimes that is that I have personally been a temp worker where I was aware that there would be a potential buyout if the company that was contracting for those services wanted to hire me full time. I think those kind of arrangements are good. They are good for everyone involved. There are potential problems, potential abuses that maybe this could be more narrowly focused on. But to have a broad, you know, no service provider may restrict, restrain, or prohibit in any way a customer from directly or indirectly soliciting or hiring an employee of a service provider, that service provider is now losing the economic incentive they have to provide that value in the first place. That economic incentive has to be built in the situation in which they're providing something akin to headhunting services, but even better in some circumstances where the customer, the company that's wanting to potentially hire them gets an opportunity to see whether that person is a rock star or whether that person is just somebody that they want to work with for a short period of time and move on. So I do appreciate at least some of the problems. I think there are some real at least potentials for abuse that we could maybe do something that's more narrowly targeted. But I think that broadly prohibiting any sort of an arrangement in which that company in the middle is prohibited from being able to set up an arrangement where they can get appropriately compensated for what they did by bringing together that labor and bringing together that company that's looking to hire that person, I think that goes too far. So I don't think this is there yet, but I do appreciate, you know, the I think the concern that's behind this bill, and maybe we can work on something that's a little bit more narrowly tailored and actually gets at the problems you're trying to solve. Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Frazier, Vice Chair Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Greenman, for bringing this bill. Do we have an idea of how many of these shadow compete clauses are out in the state of Minnesota?
Representative Greenman.
No, and that's part of the problem. We didn't actually know that this existed until, one, as you heard from our testifier, they read about it in the newspaper. When we brought this bill, we heard from a set of other industries that are relying on them. And so that's part of the problem. Again, we said and had an open conversation about non-competes, and at least with those, workers were signing a contract with them. But because of the impacts they had on mobility and the free market for labor, we got rid of them. So in this case, we don't know. Oftentimes workers don't know, and that's part of the problem.
Vice Chair Frazier.
In situations where we may have learned about these, have there been moments where there are other opt-out clauses in any of them?
Representative Greenman.
So some of these clauses are structured as, and there's some very broad prohibitions. We saw one in the child care industry, which not only prohibited hiring or soliciting during the day, but hiring or soliciting the worker at any time for any work, including 180 days after they worked there. And some of them have, as I think Representative Nisko is alluding to, like some of them have monetary clauses that will say, but again, they're monetary clauses, not with the worker, with the customer that says, if you hire someone, it's basically a liquidated damages idea. And so those are, you sort of see different ways, but most of them are pretty high, and they appear to be as much about restricting that transaction as they do about recouping those costs.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that answer. I mean, I too would kind of tweak my ears when I heard to try before you buy, because what I hear with these kind of shadow covenants is you're putting shackles on workers and you're restricting their ability to move around. I understand the work that some folks are doing to train people, get them the skills that they need to provide those workers, but I also understand what it's like to be a worker and to not have the opportunities to move up or move on, and this seems like something that we really need to address.
Thank you. All right. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin. I just wanted to run a scenario by you, Representative Greenman, and thank you for our visits on the House floor on this bill. What about a scenario where a service provider, I think that's what they're called here, right? A service provider connects a graduating high school student who's interested in being an electrician, says, I have an employer that will pay for you to go to school, get your electrician's license, and pay you to be an intern during that period of time, and then afterwards, you're obligated. They'll provide you a job after you graduate. You're going to graduate debt-free, and afterwards, all they're asking is that you remain with the company for 4 years, so that they can recoup their costs. Would this bill prohibit that connection from happening legally?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think as I hear your hypo, it is a, which brings me back to law school, it is an agreement between the worker and the company. This is actually not about and doesn't impact relationships between workers and companies. These are about contracts between two people above the head of workers, unless I misunderstood your clear. So if there's a, if what you're saying is you have an agreement with a worker, you're going to pay their education, and then they're going to have some sort of employment agreement, this doesn't impact them because this is about two service providers above their head.
Representative Scott.
So thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. So what if that's all put together by one of these third parties? What if that whole arrangement, that whole, this company will pay for your schooling, the whole nine yards, they're the middleman. They're a service provider, right? They are connecting that potential employee with a potential employer. And the potential employer has hired this third party to say, hey, will you connect with, you know, graduating high school students for us and offer them this deal?
Representative Greenman.
I think that the reason I'm struggling with this hypo is the question is who is doing the employing. If you have a business model that relies on restricting worker mobility and the free market of labor, that's a problem. Like, that's the problem we're trying to solve. If your model is linking somebody with the employer and then getting compensation back from that person, that I don't think should be a problem.
Representative Scott.
Chair Becker-Finn, I don't know if we're following on each other's wavelengths.
Maybe
here,
not.
But I wouldn't see that as necessarily in that scenario. I wouldn't see that as restricting an employee. You know, if they sign a contract saying that they're obligated to work for this company XYZ for 4 years, but they've been given all this training and expensive education, to me, that shouldn't, they should be obligated to fulfill their obligation. So maybe we can talk offline, but that's, I just don't want to, in a scenario like that, I don't want to, when we have a need for qualified people to work in different industries like we have in the trades or anything really, tech industry, I don't want there to be something in the way of making that happen for people. Because it's furthering their education and putting them on a trajectory for, you know, a good future and a good career. So I don't want anything to stand in the way of that. Thank you.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think, if the person signing the contract is the worker, this is not the bill that impacts that, because what this is about is two above the head of the worker, two businesses or whatever sort of relationship people are in, making a decision that restricts the service provider's employee. And so, and I think, again, if you have a business model that relies on restricting that person's ability to get another job, even if it is with the customer, I think that that's a problem to what Representative Frazier said, because it does actually limit the choices of that worker. It limits their opportunity to have a better job, better wages, maybe in a better environment. What we heard in testimony in the Labor Committee was folks who, it was the HOA, wanted to actually keep their front desk staff, their janitorial staff, and when they went with another service provider, they couldn't because that the employee wanted to stay, the HOA wanted them to stay, and the service provider said had this restriction in their contract. So that actually hurt. The HOA wanted to keep that person too. So there's a we haven't been talking about this, and this isn't the root of the bill, but there's also a restriction on markets for other competitors issue here too. But again, this is not about contracts that are made directly with workers, and that's part of the problem.
Seemed like a pretty good wrap-up, but Representative Greenman, if you want to say any more to wrap us up.
Yeah, I would just say, and I agree with the committee, that I think people are not products that you buy and sell. And so when we talk about workers and sort of the dignity of work, but also the free market of labor, that's what this bill is trying to do. So with that, Madam Chair, I would ask for your support.
All right. I will renew my motion to recommend that House File 3456, as amended, be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Greenman. Next up, I think I saw Representative Coulter. Yes. Representative Coulter, I will move to recommend that House File 3473 be placed on the general register. I understand you have a DE, so I will move the DE1 to get the bill in the shape you would like. All those in favor of the DE1, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Coulter, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. I will move quickly since I know, as always, you have a very packed agenda here. So House File 3473 is a policy bill brought forward by the Department of Military Affairs. The primary purpose of the bill is to ensure that relevant data collected by local law enforcement, including investigative reports and so on, must be made available to the state judge advocate for the purpose of investigation and justice proceedings under the Minnesota Code of Military Justice. Just quickly, in addition to that piece, the DE did also add a cross-reference to Chapter 13, Data Practices Act, which my understanding is sort of a commonplace thing that you folks do in this committee.
Just a little bit.
And then I did just want to draw members' attention to lines 2.10 through 2.18. When this bill was originally written, this language doesn't change anything in statute. It wasn't intended to, I should say, but it relocated existing language to a different part of statute. And when we took a look at that, we sort of realized that the language was just a bit out of date. And one example is that the previous language you can see there, it says when any criminal offense is committed. Does committed mean charged? Does it, what does that term mean? And so the language is just a bit out of date. And so we had some attorneys who are smarter than I am look at it and kind of update it. But it functions in the same fashion as existing statute. It just clarifies and updates the language a bit. And so that updates that language and then and clarifies it in addition to relocating it into a different section of statute. So that is really the extent of the bill. We have a few folks, or at least one person here with the department who can can speak to it as well.
Director Kerr can be a folk. welcome back. Director Kerr, please introduce yourself and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Don Kerr. I'm the Executive Director of the Department of Military Affairs. Representative Coulter did a great job explaining the bill. This is one of we don't like to mess around with statute unless we have to, and this is a classic example of we went in and they said, well, since we're doing that, we ought to do this. Well, since we're doing that, we ought to do this. And pretty soon it didn't spiral out of control, but it just became a bigger thing than we thought it was going to be. This is related to the same purpose as the previous bill that we talked about. But this one, we were specifically running into issues when, so the Department of Defense a couple of years ago directed that we start doing background investigations into our members for potential membership in revolutionary and reactionary organizations. And what we found was that many law enforcement agencies may be conducting investigations, but they did not decide that these investigations were really complete enough, and we had difficulty getting them to share their partial investigatory data. And we think that this fix will take care of that to give us a clearer right to the data And then we went through and made that, said, well, we're going to do that. We ought to move this section up to be next to the other relevant section. And then the very last portion of this was just reducing or eliminating some redundant information that restricted the engine only used the data for administrative or disciplinary purposes. And our lawyers pointed out, well, the only thing that the adjutant general does are administrative and disciplinary. So it's kind of redundant. So we decided to strike that at the same time. At any rate, part of the ongoing process to make things better and give us the access that we need.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate that you think a three-page bill is a lot. But I do. I appreciate that. I did have Nick Slade signed up, too, but it sounds like you don't. I don't know if you need or want.
Madam Chair, if the committee has any questions that I can't answer, we've got them on deck.
All right. So they're here if we need them. All right. Any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. Member discussion. Representative Scott.
At the risk of seeming to be uninformed, I'm just trying to parse through the amendment versus the original language, and this does seem to broaden things out a little bit. So if I heard your testimony right, this would include data on the service member that you do regardless if there's been any cause, how is it worded here, probable cause. So it goes beyond that? The data sharing goes beyond that?
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, within a narrow band it does. And so as we were tasked by the Department of Defense to seek this data on possible affiliation with extremist organizations, we may not be able to articulate a probable cause when we're talking to a local law enforcement entity that may have information that could show an affiliation that would allow us to further investigate.
Representative Scott.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. So you do that investigation. I'm assuming you do that when they're applying to be in your organization, or is that done after they've already...
Madam Chair,
Director Kerr.
There are periodic reinvestigations that have to be conducted, particularly when people have security clearances.
Right. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin. So is there a differentiation between that, what happens with that data and how that's treated, apart from the data that is a probable cause investigation on a potential criminal activity?
Director Kerr.
Madam Chair, I might ask for the lifeline.
All right. That's why you brought them to committee. Welcome to committee. Please introduce yourself and then go ahead with your response.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Nick Slade. I am the Deputy General Counsel for the Department of Military Affairs, and I'm a prior JAG officer. Representative Scott, as I understand, we do, as Mr. Kerr was trying to explain, we have a number of other types of investigations that we are required by the Department of Defense to do. He mentioned security clearances. He also mentioned we have to look at extremist activity connections between people, and that doesn't normally rise to a criminal code level, but we are also to sort of switch it into civilian terms, we're an employer. And so it becomes sort of an employee relations. We may have to restrict their access to certain things if we find that they're having connections. We'll also counsel them, but it works in a couple of different ways within the military. We're a much more encompassing of people's lives than, you know, somebody outside the military is normally thinks. When you're a member of the service, you have a lot of different connections and a lot of different concerns that we have, and we have to look into those. And they may not necessarily be criminal. I hope that answers your question.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, that doesn't answer my question.
Oh, okay.
My question is, you do that investigation on your folks, right? What happens to the data? Is that shared? Is that kept? what happens to the data from the investigation.
Oh, all right.
Investigative data.
Yes, Mr. Slade.
Thank you. When we, for instance, when we do an extremist activity investigation, that information really stays mostly in my office, the JAG's office, the attorney's office. We have to do ongoing monitoring. So the information stays with us. That would be the quickest and shortest answer.
Representative Scott.
Okay, thank you. So unlike the other part of the bill where it's being transferred to civil authorities, this information, this data, investigative data, stays within the confines of the Veterans Affairs or the Military Affairs, your folks.
Mr. Slade.
Yes. That part of the reason you're getting at it, actually, there are two different pieces of information, and that's why part of the transfer of that language into the other section. So they're now separated because that was in fact causing confusion when I was attempting to get information. They were starting to go, well, wait, is this criminal? What's going on? That's why we asked to move that section.
All right. Representative Scott, I think we're both understanding now what you were getting at.
Right,
so,
right.
Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, thank you. You're parsing it out and away from the other issue so that it's a clear distinction between the two things. Okay, I got it. Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Slade is nodding. So, any further member discussion to this bill? All right. Representative Coulter, closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the discussion. Again, I think this cleans up statute and ensures that the state judge advocate can do their job better in terms of upholding the Minnesota Military Code of Justice. I don't use that phrase very often, which is why I stumble over it, for our service members and would appreciate your support moving it forward.
All right. I renew my motion to recommend that House File 3473 as amended be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. I'm just pulling rank. I'm going to move. Representative Feist is hung up in another committee, but I'm going to go ahead and move House File 3925 and recommend that it be placed on the general register. My understanding that this is a bill that the State Bar Association was seeking, and so we do have some testifiers who I believe can speak to the bill. So please, thank you for your willingness to step in so we can get this done today. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian Lake, I have a solo practice law firm in Minneapolis. I also represent the Minnesota State Bar Association. Madam Chair, as you mentioned, this is a bar proposal. It deals with transfer on death deeds, which are a really popular way for people to transfer their interest in property. They can record a document before their death that transfers their interest in property upon their death to whomever they designate. A lot of people do this with attorneys, and they're, in that case, almost always done correctly. There's also a lot of situations where people draft on their own, and there can be a lot of errors that end up causing the document to be invalid and therefore the transfer of the property to be invalid. So there's some provisions in here that deal with those technical aspects and try to make those more viable. And then there's another chunk that deals with how these properties are insured after death in response to an Eighth Circuit decision that's caused some problems for people when they end up not having coverage. So those are the two elements. I have with me Kevin Dunleavy with the real property section of the bar, who can explain in a little more detail.
All right. Mr. Dunleavy, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Kevin Dunleavy. I co-chair the Legislative Committee of the Real Property Section, and we draft bills like we drafted the original transfer on death deed. And that's been actually very popular with the public because people can transfer their property without having to go through a probate, which can be quite expensive. I'd like to thank Representative Feist for co-sponsoring the bill. I hope she heard me. And I'd also like to thank the Insurance Federation of Minnesota and Mr. Cocking for working with us in order to deal with how do you get coverage, how do you expand coverage after somebody's dead and they're no longer insured. So the first section of the bill is mostly technical corrections, where these are mostly where individuals without an attorney drafted a transfer on death deed and made some mistakes, and we're trying to make them work. And so the result of the mistakes that these people make is that there has to be a probate. And so by fixing those, that'll result in less probate. So an example is there's two grantees on a transfer on death deed, and one of them dies before the grantor. What happens to that person's interest? Some people were saying, well, it goes back to the grantor, and there has to be a probate now. Well, I mean, the whole purpose of this was to avoid probates. So this is going to try to address that and say, now it's just the grantee's heirs can take the property. It doesn't go back to the grantor. And then another common problem is either recording it in the wrong place, like Minnesota has two property record system, Torrens and Abstract, and if you record it in one but not the other, that's considered recorded. Recorded is the main operative act with a transfer on death deed. It has to be recorded before the moment of death. And then once the person dies, that's when the title transfers. Because title can't be in a vacuum. It has to be somewhere. So it's the grantor until the moment of death, then it goes to the grantee. Okay, so then the second part of the bill deals with the insurance issue. So what happened with this Eighth Circuit case, mom and dad are married, dad has leukemia. I think they're concerned about medical assistance, liens, and so they divorce. It was a friendly divorce. Then dad dies, but about a week before he died, he granted a transfer on death deed to his niece. Well, after he died, the nieces moved in and tried to kick out the wife, the ex-wife, and she burned the house down. And since the owner had already died, since the husband had already died, the insurance lapsed. Mm-hmm. And so what this does is it gives another 30 days of extended coverage so that the grantees will have some time to go get some other coverage. So I don't know if you want me to get into more detail.
We'll see if we need to, but thank you. And I think, you know, when somebody's grieving, I don't think the first thing at the top of their list is, oh no, do I need to go find homeowners insurance or insurance for a property? So I appreciate you describing that. Any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? Right, not seeing any. We'll move on to member discussion. Representative Carroll, remember we got one more bill today.
Real quickly, thank you, Chair. So is 30 days sufficient time, do you think?
Mr. Dunleavy.
Madam Chair and Representative Carroll, that was the compromise with the Insurance Federation. So we basically made that deal to give 30 days. There are some other notice provisions in here that at the time of the deed, the new forms, which the Bar Association promulgates and the Commerce Department publishes, those are gonna have like a warning to the grantee to go out and get insurance. So we're trying to address it in a couple different ways so that the grantees will know about it and the grantor will know about it too. Grantor needs to tell the grantees to get insurance as well.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, thank you. All right. I guess there are no closing comments because Representative Feist isn't here. She's presenting, for the record, she's presenting a bill in another committee across the hall, and Representative Mueller presented a bill for me yesterday, so I'm paying it forward, and we're just going to get Representative Feist's bill done. So with that, Representative Scott.
Just real quickly, she should really get her priorities straight, Madam Chair. This is the right committee to be presenting it.
I mean, I agree with you.
Thank you.
Representative Feist carries a lot of bills. It's part of the game. So with that, I will renew my motion that House File 3925 be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Congratulations, Representative Feist. All right, last but not least, Representative Elkins. I will move that House File 2309 be referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. I understand that you have an A5 amendment. Do you want to take care of that first?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. So
All right. Let me move it. All right. I will move the A5 amendment in front of us. Go ahead, Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The A5 amendment has a lot of wordsmithing. I'm kind of at that phase in the development of the bill, but there are two of those changes are somewhat substantive. One of them includes what I think is going to be the final definition of the specific geolocation. This is an issue that has been kind of heavily negotiated in the development of the bill. Over time, I've become something of an expert on geolocational privacy and realize that the common definition in most other state bills isn't actionable or enforceable. I think I've got one here that is specific enough that people would know whether or not they're conforming to it, whether their data would be considered sensitive under this definition, and it's specific enough to be enforceable as well. And the second change was requested by our medtech industry. A lot of them live in kind of a gray area where it's not completely clear whether they're covered or by HIPAA or not. So most of these companies playing it safe do comply with HIPAA, and the second part of the amendment says if you are a medtech company actually complying with HIPAA, then you can live under HIPAA rather than under this bill.
All right, and then I understand there's an oral amendment that I will make.
Mm-hmm.
So I will move the following oral amendment on line 1.21 of the A5 amendment, delete the word no and insert no's. Some members understand. My understanding is just a grammatical catch. Mm-hmm. All right. All those in favor of the oral amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? All right. Amendment motion prevails. And then any discussion to the A5 as amended by the oral amendment? Otherwise, we'll get the bill. All right. So then I will move the A5 as amended. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Representative Elkins, your bill is in the shape that you would like it, so please tell us about your bill.
Yep, thank you, Madam Chair. So this is a comprehensive consumer data privacy bill. Bills like this have now passed in 13 other states. 12 of those states based on the same template that I've used for this bill, which is commonly referred to as the Washington Privacy Act template because it was originally developed by a state senator in the state of Washington named Reuven Carlisle, who took the kind of hurriedly crafted and sloppily worded California laws and rationalized them, made them much easier to read. And he did such a good job that it's become the template that has been used in all other states that have passed these kinds of laws since then. Specifically, my bill was used as a starting point, the Connecticut version of this bill, which was very well vetted. And so that was my jumping off point on this bill. So the objective of using this common template among the states is that all of us who are pursuing these laws at the state level recognize that this is something that really ought to be taken up by Congress. But clearly Congress doesn't have the stomach to take it up. There's no action. And so what we are doing is collaborating as state legislators across state to make our bills as common as possible. That being said, every one of these 13 bills that have already passed are different in some respects. And so, for example, I've taken one small business provision out of the state of Texas's law. I've taken another provision related to certain industry exemptions from Oregon's law. And I'm lobbied constantly by various parties to adopt the weakest provision that is found in any of these laws, and I haven't done that. So the basic consumer rights that are established by these bills is the right to know that what data a company has about you, the right to have inaccurate data corrected, the right to have your data deleted, the right to obtain a copy of your data, the right to opt out of having your data sold, used for targeted advertising, or used to profile you, and we'll talk about that in a minute. There is anticipation that a universal opt-out method will be developed. It's under development, and if you have DuckDuckGo or Mozilla Firefox, there's a mechanism already there. But when that becomes generally available, it will be covered under this law. And the bill, of course, also spells out how consumers can exercise these rights, including appeals processes. So the one additional right that I've put into my bill that is so far unique to ours is that in this NCSL work group that I've been participating in covers cybersecurity, data privacy, and artificial intelligence. Most of the programming is related to artificial intelligence this year. And one of the focal points within that has been what's called in the AI context, automated decision making. Within this context, it's just referred to profiling. So profiling is some things like your determination of your credit scores is the best example. So instead of trying to craft a whole new bill, a whole new section of law governing automated decision making, I just added a provision into this bill governing profiling, which is the same thing, that basically extends that the rights that we all already have under the Fair Credit Reporting Act to other areas of major decision making, like am I going to get that apartment, what auto insurance am I going to get, am I going to get this job, extends those same kinds of protections to those kinds of decisions as well, so that you would have the ability to question the scores coming out of that profile, have the right to request, what were the decision criteria and how could I have behaved in a way that would improve the score next time. So this is new and unique, but artificial intelligence experts that I've been talking to are telling me, Steve, you're doing it the right way. This is the best way to extend these kinds of protections. So the bill, other major category, is it imposes restrictions on our controllers. Controllers are the companies that create and control your data, and they must provide a clearly written privacy policy. Collect only the data that they need to do business with you and nothing more. They have to secure and protect your data, and they have to secure your consent before processing or selling your data if it's about race, religion, ethnicity, et cetera, biometric or genetic information, data about known children, or your GPS location and accuracy that would reveal your street address. And they very importantly have to produce an annual assessment that discusses how they're complying with these requirements. There are a few things that I think I've improved upon the general framework. And just in wrapping up here, Madam Chair, the definition of precise geolocation basically says geolocation data accurate enough to identify a street address. It explicitly prohibits the re-identification of de-identified and pseudonymous data by third parties. We talked about how it extends the rights of the Fair Credit Reporting Act to other decisions that are made at you. And I put in explicit what are called privacy by design requirements in the annual assessment, so the companies would have to discuss their policies related to data minimization, data retention, and how they keep track of the data that they have about you. I've been asked to address one point in particular question, which is why doesn't the bill include a private right of action? And at the beginning, I mentioned how we refer to this bill framework as the Washington Privacy Act because it was developed by a state senator in the state of Washington. But ironically, this bill has never passed in the state of Washington, and it has never passed in the state of Washington because when the bill was considered in their state legislature, the Senate position was that no, we should not include a private right of action. The House position was that no, we're not going to pass this bill without a private right of action. And as a result of that stalemate, the Washington Privacy Act has never passed in the state of Washington. So no state since then has included a private right of action in their legislation. There are no state laws that have passed so far that include a private right of action. We can always add it later if it's deemed necessary, but I've been working very closely with the Attorney General's office here. They, in turn, have been comparing notes with their counterparts in other states that have already passed these bills, like Colorado and Connecticut and Oregon. The reason this bill is going to the State Government Committee next is because there is a fairly significant AG fiscal note related to their enforcement, but the AG's office, who apologizes for not being here today, is quite confident, based on their comparison of notes with their counterparts in other states, that they will be able to enforce this law.
Representative Elkins, we have enough drama in our legislature. We don't really need to know what they're fighting about in other legislatures, but I appreciate the depth of your knowledge on this issue. I do have one person signed up to testify, Bruce Newstead. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bruce Newstead with the Minnesota Retailers Association. I work with about 1,200 retail storefronts across the state, some of your favorite Main Street brands, regional retailers, and national retailers as well. Just wanted to provide just a moment, a comment today to thank Representative Elkins for all his work on this bill over literally the years. His countless conversations has resulted in a work product that I think we're still working on, but we're definitely getting there. I think, as Representative Elkins mentioned, there's an important element of trying to, I think he might have used the word, get really prescriptive to other states, but provide some alignment with other states, especially in my case if you're a retailer operating across multiple states. So we appreciate that work. There are a few areas we want to continue to work on. We appreciate the geolocation changes, want to continue to look at that a little bit and some of the other elements of the bill. And Madam Chair, really specifically for your committee and to end where Representative Elkins just ended, we do think sort of that Attorney General's approach to compliance on this bill and enforcement is important. It's not a three-page bill. It's a 25-page bill that's full of some hyper-technical definitions. Some of those things only exist right now in Representative Elkins' head relative to their understanding. So we do think it's really important that that Attorney General as the professional and his staff work with consumers and retailers and other impacted parties to be able to enforce this legislation. So thank you for your time today.
All right, thank you. And I will note, too, we had a thorough hearing and discussion in the Data Practices Commission on this bill as well. All four of us on this committee are on that commission. So I do want to note that there was even more time spent on fleshing things out there. Don't have anyone else signed up, but are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right, not seeing any, we will move on to member discussion. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin. Thank you, Representative Elkins. Like many others have said, the conversations that you have facilitated around this bill. And I appreciate, I wanted to highlight a couple, I think, good things about your approach. One is I agree with Mr. Newstead's comments about the Attorney General enforcement. I think this is one of those areas of law where it's important that we have a professional, politically accountable agency responsible for bringing cases and helping us sort out what the law means in this area instead of just individual individual cases brought by anybody, and this is more of a issue of statewide concern that I think the Attorney General is the right actor to be responsible for enforcing. The other thing I did want to highlight, which is an important part of your approach that I appreciate, is the desire to make sure that a company that's operating across state lines is going to be playing by, at least similar sets of rules in different states, and we're not creating big compliance problems. And so I wanted to really dig into, and I'm just sort of thinking a little bit out loud about the changes in the geolocation provision that you say is a unique one. It looks like, the way I understand it, that feeds into the definition of sensitive data, and then sensitive data is something that's restricted or that those data processors or companies holding the data have to deal with. And so I'd like to hear your thoughts, I guess, about does the different definition or different, terms we're using here materially change the way that those companies have to think about sensitive data in Minnesota compared to other states? I think probably not, but that's what I'm still trying to wrap my head around.
Sure. Representative Elkins.
Thank you. So the more standard definition used in most state laws is either within 1,700 or 1,850 feet, so roughly a third of a mile. But a third of a mile doesn't correspond to any degree of accuracy in any GPS coordinate system. So I posed the question to the stakeholder community, if you think that your data qualifies as non-sensitive under the other state's laws, tell me how you know that. And not a single party has been able to come back to me and tell me how they know whether their data lies within or without a one-third of a mile circle. So the way that our geolocation is determined, whether we're talking about these things or the equally accurate device in our cars, is by what are known as decimal degrees of latitude and longitude. So these devices record our location down to 7 digits of geolocational accuracy, which is down to about an inch. So somebody reading the data off this phone would not only know that we're in a conference room in the state office building, but if you're Google and also recording the altitude, they would know that we are not in the basement conference room. We are in room 5. That's how accurate they are. So in my definition, I said that anything more than 3 decimal units of accuracy is considered sensitive. So, and that's because it generally takes 4 degrees of decimal accuracy to determine a street address. And to me, that's the most important thing, because once you have, say, the street address where this device spends the night, when you get up in the morning and check the weather report, and the weather app records that, yep, Steve is checking his weather from, you know, at this latitude and longitude down to 7 degrees of accuracy, that's how they know where you live. And once they have your home address, there is all kinds of information that is publicly available, from property tax records, voting records, if you can get a hold of them, that can be used to re-identify what has been created as pseudonymous information. So in general, the only thing that's being recorded in terms of identity is the advertising IDs associated with this device, or the device IDs associated with this device. But if you can determine the address of this device, then you can reverse engineer all of those pseudonymous identifiers, and then the whole online advertising agency knows that this device ID, this advertising ID belongs to Harry Niska. And the way I've got this defined, that I've made it much harder for that to happen.
Representative Niska. Ask a long question, get a long answer.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin. Thank you, Representative Elkins, for that very detailed and in some ways a little too personal answer. In all seriousness, I mean, I think whatever any of us think about, government regulation and other areas of life, I think there's a broad recognition in the year 2024 that one of the important individual rights and property interests that we all have is in our own is in the data about us that's out there floating around in the world. And I think this is a really, like I said, a measured and balanced really detailed way that you've worked through this issue, and so I appreciate all the work that you've done on it. Thank you.
Thank you. I could regale you for half an hour with horror stories about locational data privacy.
We got 11
violations,
minutes,
but you probably don't want me to do that. Yeah.
and I think Representative Niska, it is easy to kind of joke about the nerdiness of this, but I appreciate you mentioning too that this is really serious. Privacy issues and things that we should all be thinking about. And I do appreciate all the work you've done over the years on this issue, Representative Elkins. Hopefully this is finally the year. Any other members, member discussion? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin. And I want to thank Representative Elkins. You've got the patience of Job here going. You've been working on this for a long time.
5 years.
You've been patient. Yeah. But it was counting, right?
No.
It is an important issue, and this bill's come a long way. And I know that you're probably going to want to go out and celebrate if this thing passes and just get it behind you. But I think it's important, all the different iterations and everything that you've had and everything. I think it's important to note that don't let the perfect get in the way of the good. And so I think while you probably are still saying this is a work in progress, at some point we need to pass something, and then it can be tweaked as it goes along, as we figure out what works and what doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to thank you for doing a yeoman's work on this. And who's the Senate author, Madam Chair?
Representative Elkins.
Senator, guys, being heard this afternoon, Bonnie Westland.
I think it's Senator Westland.
Yeah, she's being it's being heard in the Senate Commerce Committee this afternoon.
Yeah, Senator Westland, the chair this year of the Data Practices Commission.
Yep. Right. Okay. Well,
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn, and thank you, Representative Elkins, and for all of your work on this. It really has been a heavy lift. So.
Thank you.
And I apologize. I didn't see Representative Feist before you went, Representative Scott, but we'll hear from all four members of the Data Practices Commission on this committee. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say thank you to Representative Elkins as well. These types of bills are so hard because it's hard, like, unless you're on the Data Practices Commission, you're not necessarily passionate about these issues, but they matter so much. And it's so hard to get ahead of technology. Mm-hmm. And once we're using all this technology and companies are using it, it's so hard to then rein that back in and create these protections. And I've just been so impressed. Like, you've had meetings where you've given PowerPoints to try to make sure that we all understood the bill. And when we first talked about it, I was like, this is a big, grand idea, one day maybe. And, like, here we are. It's just amazing. So I just, congratulations. I'm really excited about this bill, and thank you so much for all your work on it. It is so important.
All right, closing comments, Representative Elkins.
Yeah, I've got literally 125 people on my email notification for this bill, and none of them are shy. So every time I have a major revision to the bill, I send out an email that goes to 125 people. So, you know, to the extent that you're saying, yeah, but this is still a work in progress, I've got one more committee stop, but you can see most of the changes that are being made now are just kind of wordsmithing. But this is not going to be finished. It's going to be like the Data Practices Act. It's going to be a living chapter of law. It will evolve from year to year. Over the last weekend, I received a report from the Connecticut Attorney General. Their law has been in effect now for 6 months. They've been enforcing it. They gave a report back to the legislature on the first 6 months. And, I get the back, there's a section on legislative recommendations. And it's like, oh, that would be a good idea. That would be a good idea. Not going to happen this year, but, you know, next year we'll probably be coming back and tweaking it, yes.
All right. Thank you, Representative Elkins. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 2309, as amended, be referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
All right. We are done with our agenda for the day. Thank you, members, for keeping us on track. We'll see you on Thursday. We are adjourned.